Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. There's plenty of Appalachians making a difference in this world, and on today's show, we're going to share just a few of their stories. We'll hear from a pioneer who changed the way frail elderly people live.
I began to think about all of the places in the United States where I knew there was no assisted living, where I knew there were no services, that even if we had a Medicare and Medicaid, it didn't make much difference because you couldn't get to it. It led me right back down to McDowell County, Mingo County, Wyoming County, where I was born.
And a scientist who's trying to make burning coal more environmentally friendly.
My grandfather, he lived to be 87 years old for decades of that with black lung. So for me, working in West Virginia is really a mandate.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for tuning in. You're one of a growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We've teamed up with the producers of the radio documentary by West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Inspiring West Virginians to bring you this week's Inside Appalachia. The series celebrates Mountain State natives who are leaders in science and business. And these aren't the kind of stories you'll likely hear from national media outlets. You might have noticed that the national lens is often quick to focus on the challenges of our region rather than our successes. But those images don't define us. It's our individual and often inspiring stories that reveal our true identities, I think. We'll start by going to McDowell County, West Virginia, to meet a coal miner's daughter. Karen Brown Wilson was quite young when her father died of black lung and was still in college when her mother became very ill and landed in a nursing home. As Jean Snediger reports, those experiences helped guide Wilson's significant contribution to elder care.
Join me in congratulating the 2015 Aegis Award winners, Worth and Barbara Caldwell.
The grand ballroom at the Multnomah Athletic Club in downtown Portland, Oregon. More than 300 people are here to celebrate the accomplishments of older Americans who are making a significant contribution to their communities.
The youngest of the three today.
But people are here partly because of the accomplishments of today's organizer, one of America's foremost gerontologists. She's the pioneer of assisted living in the United States and worldwide.
What is amazing about Karen is that she truly cares. From the moment she wakes up in the morning until she falls asleep at night, she's making a difference.
Today's celebration also marks the 25th anniversary of the very first licensed assisted living facility in the United States.
My name is Karen Brown Wilson, and I am a gerontologist. That is someone who works and studies in the field of aging. I was born in War, West Virginia, which is the southernmost city in West Virginia, and I spent my early years there.
66-year-old Karen Brown Wilson's story is featured in the book Being Mortal by Boston surgeon Atul Gawande. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year. And it tells the story of how Wilson revolutionized the way millions of older people live.
It really all started with my mom. My mother had a stroke at age 55, which is really young, and she lived for the next 10 years in nursing homes. And she was poor, so she was a Medicaid client, and that meant not very many choices for her. And when I told her that I was going to become a gerontologist, she said, well, what does that mean? And I said, well, that's the study about older adults. And she said, well, then why aren't you doing something to help people like me?
At the time, Wilson's mother, Jessie F. Richardson, was living in a traditional nursing home, which was based on the medical model of care.
Nursing homes were really stripped-down hospitals. People were in a ward. They were literally in a bed. They were told when to go to bed. They were told when to get up. They were told what to eat. They were told what they could do, what they couldn't do. They really had no autonomy. They had no say in their lives. And that was very dehumanizing.
Wilson's mother let her know what it was like to have to live in a bed with few choices.
She wanted to have her cat. She wanted to be able to have her Vicks Vapor Rub in the drawer next to her. She wanted to go to bed when she wanted. She wanted to have temperature control. She wanted her own things. She said that because she was frail, she wasn't sick, and she didn't want to be treated like she was sick. So I just did my best to try to make her life easier, but she planted a seed, and I began thinking about how could we make life easier for people who needed support, who were not ill, but who were frail because of some disability. And that led me to think about creating a new form of long-term care, now called assisted living.
After becoming a professor of gerontology at Portland State University, Wilson and her husband, Michael DeShane, also a gerontologist, wanted to create a safe place for elders like her mother, but also a place where they felt like life was worth living. They borrowed several $1 million to build a facility.
We built this like an apartment house. We built it with locking doors, individual temperature control. We built it with a kitchen. And so you couldn't tell from the outside that it wasn't a normal apartment building.
The state licensing people went nuts, telling them, this is against the rules, that's against the rules. But Karen wasn't deterred. She camped out at their offices until she got them to give her a special license. And she wasn't through yet.
One day, literally, I was thinking, how am I going to do this for poor people? I said, I'm just going to go back and say I can do it for less money. You give me anybody you want to, living in your nursing home, I'll take care of them, and I'll do it for a flat rate. And you can pick the people to send to me. And I want to do a pilot, and I want to show you that we can take care of people meeting any requirements you have for less money.
And at the time, nobody believed this could be done.
That's true. No one really believed it could be done. No one thought that we could give nursing care in a non-nursing setting. No one believed that people would be safe. I mean, people were convinced that it would kill people.
Against all odds, they succeeded. Not only did that early facility serve lower-income people for a flat rate, the pilot study showed that residents had better health outcomes than those who lived in nursing homes. The concept of assisted living, or more specifically, Karen's vision of it, was born.
So, Jean, we're on our way south, about 45 minutes south of Portland, to Canby, Oregon, which is where the first licensed assisted living is. And that is a building that my husband and I built. It is a small building and it has 25 units. Canby, Oregon is a small farming community, and it represented the kind of place where people didn't want to leave their community could stay in their community and receive care. I love Ratcliffe. It's like a child to me. There's something special about this place because I had this vision that a small place could work, and that meant they could go in lots of small communities.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm Lori.
Built in a wooded setting, from the outside, Ratcliffe Place looks like a large one-story craftsman home. As you walk in the door, immediately on the left is a wall of photos of young adults from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. The current residents of Ratcliffe. We pass an elegant living room, a beauty salon, a laundry, and a dining room with a choice of menu items.
One of the things that's unique about this is the design, because it's in a square with an interior courtyard, so you can't get lost.
In the beautiful courtyard with shrubbery and flowers, we see residents walking their dogs. Cats are around too.
This was the model of what we would call resident-centered care, where the schedule is built around the resident and not the home.
How did you resolve this issue between the resident's desires and safety?
I was told once by a person I respected a lot is that what we want for ourselves is autonomy, and what we want for those that we love is safety. And so we came up with the idea called negotiated risk, which we try to figure out what are some reasonable actions we can take to help people do what they want to do. So it's trying to moderate risk or manage risk.
This new model of care for the elderly got lots of national media coverage. Shortly after, Karen was approached by investors from Wall Street to take the idea public. For the next few years, she oversaw the building of hundreds of assisted living facilities across the U.S., which included 3,000 employees in 18 states. But in the process, she felt her original vision got lost in the desire for profit and the fear of liability if someone was hurt. By the end of the 1990s, Wilson left the world of corporate assisted living and started a foundation, the Jessie F. Richardson Foundation, named after her mother, to help underserved elders in the U.S. and around the world. The foundation's first big project was in Nicaragua. Working with an array of people in the community, Wilson developed the first assisted living facility in that country.
I began to think about all of the places in the United States where I knew there was no assisted living, where I knew there were no services, that even if we had a Medicare and Medicaid, it didn't make much difference because you couldn't get to it. And where did it lead me back to? It led me right back down to McDowell County, Mingo County, Wyoming County, where I was born.
Since then, Karen, through the Jessie F. Richardson Foundation, has been researching how she can help underserved communities in West Virginia. Gary Withers, an executive for Concordia University in Portland, Oregon, is on the board of the Jessie F. Richardson Foundation.
Karen, because it's her roots, is truly inspired by the opportunities and the challenges in West Virginia, and in particular, trying to find solutions for isolated elderly, elders who live in the hollows, elders who are not reached regularly by dental care or physical health care or mental health care. And she'll work with the local leaders and local communities to be able to craft solutions that are organic to West Virginia, that are West Virginian solutions. Karen epitomizes what it means to be a philanthropist. But even more importantly, she's an extraordinary American visionary.
One issue where Karen wants to help is with the number of grandparents raising grandchildren because the parents are addicted to drugs. Though the project is still in its early stages, Karen's husband, Michael DeShane, has no doubt that she will be successful.
Karen's is like driven, you know, very different than I am, and that's probably why we managed to stay together. I'm, you know, we'll get through this, we'll just do this, let's build a building, let's take our time, and she's, no, we gotta do this, we gotta do that, we gotta do this. There's just something inside her that pushes her and pushes her and pushes her.
The drive inside Karen Brown Wilson was nurtured in West Virginia.
I was born in war, but I believe that the name of the mining camp that we lived in was called Bartley.
She was the seventh of eight children. The family was very poor.
There was a flood. We lived on this little creek. And I can remember my dad putting me on his shoulders and taking me across this swinging bridge and walking down the highway to a coal tipple. And then we had to cross the coal tipple to get back on the other side of the river. I can remember the Red Cross coming, and I got a new pair of shoes. I can remember walking down the railroad tracks with my mom. She'd have a sack, and she'd be picking greens. And she'd point out, this is one we can eat, we can't eat this one.
Wilson's father was a coal miner who got black lung early on. He died when she was in grade school. And her mother decided to send the three youngest children, including Karen, back to the hollows of East Tennessee to live with a grandmother. Neither of Karen's parents went beyond the eighth grade, but education was very important to them.
My parents loved to read. I think that's how I learned to read before I went to school. And my mother and father felt that no matter what we didn't have, what we would have is school.
A seventh grade teacher made a big impression on Karen.
Mrs. Duncan told me, you know, you could do whatever you want. You're a smart girl.
And you believed her?
I did believe her because my mom had told me the same thing. So that was two adults that had told me that. And don't worry about what other people think. And that was a really positive message. And the thing that I learned from that message is that it's really important to be thoughtful about what we tell children because they remember.
All but one of Karen's siblings went on to earn college degrees. Karen decided to go as far out of the hollows as she could get and received a scholarship from the University of Washington in Seattle. Karen and her only surviving sibling eventually both earned PhDs.
Your brother that's still living is rather well known in his own right.
That's right. We call him Rocket Boy. My brother's Quentin. He was one of the group of boys that was written about in the book Rocket Boys and in the movie October Sky. He lives today in Amarillo, Texas. We talk several times a week, and he was a role model for me. He was always the brainy one. I like to say that I'm living proof that the war on poverty worked for one person. I was very, very fortunate to get a scholarship. And my brother says that winning the science fair was what allowed him to go to college. So we both benefited from the generosity and the investment that others made in us.
And in turn, Karen Brown Wilson generously gives scholarships to young students. Not only that, her ideas and drive have transformed the way millions of older Americans live. Today, there are more than 40,000 assisted living facilities in the United States and thousands more worldwide.
You founded a worldwide industry. Today, it's probably worth hundreds of billions of dollars. People call you a revolutionary entrepreneur, the mother of assisted living. What do you want to be remembered for?
I would like to be remembered as someone who cared about those who had less than they needed to live comfortably. I would like to be remembered as someone who believed that you could make things happen if you put your mind to it. I don't know what else more I could want except to somehow be able to do more for others.
Where does that come from? What drives you?
From a religious perspective, there is the perspective that those for whom much is given, much is expected. My mother, this is a true story, when my dad was sick and we didn't have much to eat, a hobo came to our door asking for money, and my mom said, "I don't have any money, but you can have supper with us." And we had oatmeal for supper. And I asked her why she was giving away our food, and she said, "There are those that could do and don't. There are those that would like to and can't. And there are those that can and do, and you want to be the third kind of person." We always are able to do more than we think we can. And I just want to do as much as I can.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to hear from another West Virginian who's recognized worldwide for her leadership.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. On this week's show, we're hearing from inspiring West Virginians, people who help us see our own possibilities and show us it's possible to overcome obstacles. People like Kanawha County native Marilyn Johnson. She runs an international organization dedicated to developing leadership among women. Marilyn carried titles such as cheerleading captain, beauty queen, and today, Marilyn Johnson is now a CEO and leader of women across the world. Again, producer Jean Snediger introduces us to this inspiring West Virginian.
Oh, Jean, we're on Pennsylvania Avenue now. This is the direct route from the White House to the nation's capital, so the president going back and forth to work.
Marilyn Johnson, CEO of one of the most prestigious women's organizations in the world, the International Women's Forum, headquartered in Washington, D.C. Johnson grew up in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia.
My earliest and fond memory of this was as a sixth grader at Vandalia Elementary School. I was selected to represent the patrol, the safety patrol troop, and march down Pennsylvania Avenue. That was probably my foray into leadership.
And I remember a former global executive for IBM, today Marilyn Johnson is one of the most high-profile African-American businesswomen in the country. And from the time she was a small child, Johnson, the middle of five children, had a fire in her belly to succeed. But being from an African-American family in the Kanawha Valley of the 1950s, there were certainly hurdles to overcome.
Being born in West Virginia in 1953 in South Charleston was truly an opportunity for me to grow up in an integrated environment. But my parents were smart enough to put me from Sunday school into kindergarten, where it was literally in the garage of a lady, a teacher, probably a retired teacher, because I remember Miss Catherine was older and very beautiful. And she taught me how to read, and she taught me my colors, and she taught me how to spell my name and write my name. That education I got through church and Miss Catherine's garage was Head Start before Head Start had a title. So I had confidence.
Despite that confidence, when she started first grade at Central Elementary School in St. Albans, many of the children didn't want to play with Marilyn. Indeed, they had been told not to play with her. So she set a strategy that she would define herself. They wouldn't.
If there was a spelling bee, I wanted to be one of the last ones standing. If we all had to go to the chalkboard to do math, I took my time to print neatly, check my work before they called on me to explain my problem and how. I wanted to excel, and I had educators that saw more in me, I think, than I saw in myself.
People like her fifth grade teacher, Miss Johnson.
Miss Johnson in the fifth grade really made me feel like I could soar. And I'll never forget just feeling comfortable in her presence. She never yelled, raised her voice. She wasn't an imposing personality. Quiet, smart, serene, and I wanted to be so much like her. And her name was Johnson, and maybe I'm related to her. I would daydream.
In junior high, Marilyn made the honor roll. She also excelled in sports and cheerleading.
Being the first Black cheerleader of South Charleston Junior High School was challenging because I had to befriend young women who had a whole different background than I did. But I remember Donna and Penny and Beth. I remember these young girls that treated me like I was from their neighborhood. They made me feel one of the core.
When Marilyn was nine, her parents divorced. Then, right before high school, she went to live with her grandmother and blind great-grandmother in Bell, West Virginia, to help out, and went to DuPont High School, where she was a cheerleader and vice president of her class. One teacher, Beverly Conklin, made a huge impression.
She was so compassionate and so understanding because she knew I was living with a grandmother, helping take care of a great-grandmother, and the responsibilities I had at home. she really was encouraging and supportive and predicted my success and even told me later, I always knew you would go far in this world. I'm so proud of you. For a teacher to tell you 20 years later that they saw in you what you're living, it brings tears to my eyes. So I'll never forget her. She was wonderful.
At Marshall, Marilyn Johnson was the head cheerleader in the years immediately following the 1970 plane crash disaster that killed more than 70 Thundering Herd players, coaches, and boosters. It was a somber time when the football team was rebuilding. She also became Miss Huntington, worked as the weekend weather girl at WSAZ-TV, and earned two master's degrees in education. But after teaching briefly in Cabell County, Johnson headed for California to interview with IBM.
I knew from the very first conversation with the very first manager at IBM that if I invested in my career the way I invested in my education in West Virginia, it was a meritocracy. The better performance that you delivered, the more opportunities that you would receive. And with that comes leadership, compensation, escalation, and success, defined by moving up that corporate ladder.
Which is exactly what Johnson did. Over a period of 35 years, while raising her two children, she went from showing customers how to use IBM business equipment to vice president in charge of developing IBM strategy for marketing to businesses that were owned by ethnically diverse people and women leaders around the world. In that role, she expanded IBM's market share significantly. When she retired in 2012, IBM had nearly 400,000 employees in more than 70 countries, and it remains an iconic leader in the IT industry.
My name is Denise Evans, and I am the Vice President for Women and Diversity Marketing at the IBM Corporation.
Denise Evans succeeded Marilyn Johnson at IBM. They worked together 8 years.
Marilyn is perpetually visionary. She's a lifelong learner. She really is inspirational. So it was just great working for her. She's always uplifting. Even when maybe giving constructive criticism, it's uplifting.
After her retirement from IBM, Marilyn Johnson continued her volunteer service to various business, civic, and arts organizations, as well as public speaking work. Then, in 2014, came the biggest challenge of Marilyn Johnson's career. She was invited to be the new chief executive officer of the International Women's Forum.
Our leadership development experience helps women in 33 countries on 6 continents find their voice, find their network, educate on expert topics, and raise their influence level around the world. There are 6,200 members currently connected through technology, and then meeting face-to-face in conferences that are held around the world.
This global network of preeminent women leaders across all fields and professions not only comes together to help each other, but it also provides programs to develop future women leaders. Of course, another draw to take the new position in Washington, D.C., was that it brought Marilyn Johnson, the little girl from the Kanawha Valley, closer to home and family.
My parents are in their 80s. This makes it really convenient. I can be home in just a few hours. I can wake up and know that I can have lunch or dinner or both with my parents in West Virginia. So when I go home, I go to West Virginia. There is a true benefit to being from a place that wants you to succeed and wants you to represent the best of its values. And we're small enough as a state to claim and know each other, yet we're broad enough in talent and skill to touch the whole world.
You can hear more of this interview with Marilyn Johnson on our website at wvpublic.org. And while you're there, you'll find pictures and stories of other inspiring West Virginians featured on this and past seasons. We're hearing stories of inspiring West Virginians on today's show. I always find it interesting to find out who inspiring folks were inspired by, like Professor Brian Anderson, who says he was driven to become a scientist by his grandfather, who is a coal miner. Next, producer Gene Snediger introduces us to an award-winning scientist at WVU. Professor Brian Anderson is working to make West Virginia's energy sources more productive and environmentally sustainable. But science isn't the only field Brian Anderson excels in. Brian has also mastered the art of singing. He currently sings with the Mendelssohn Choir of Pittsburgh. Music remains one of Brian Anderson's passions, and that shouldn't surprise us now that science has established the correlation between music talent and math and science aptitude. Again, Gene Snediger brings us this story.
Recently in science, it was reported that West Virginia is a geothermal hotspot. Now, really? That probably would surprise a lot of you.
We know Professor Brian Anderson, a chemical engineer and director of the West Virginia University Energy Institute, giving a TED Talk in Pittsburgh.
But it is, in fact, a pretty good geothermal resource. So if we can find cheap ways...
37-year-old Brian Anderson, a native of Roane County, is a global expert on geothermal energy. That is, energy we get from deep beneath the Earth's surface, as he calls it, the heat under our feet.
A few years ago, some colleagues of mine at Southern Methodist University, in collaboration with Google, identified a hotspot here in West Virginia, where it really seems that the best geothermal resources here close to the East Coast happen to be here in the mountains of West Virginia. And so that really excites me for sure. A native West Virginian interested in geothermal energy, it just seems serendipitous. It's not the most economical here, but that's where we come in. That's where advanced research comes in. That's what we're trying to do, is find ways that it can be simultaneously environmentally friendly and economical and can help us provide a new and additional energy source from the state of West Virginia.
Anderson is not just interested in geothermal energy, for which he received his PhD from MIT. He's the world's leading authority on gas hydrates, an untapped resource under the oceans and in Arctic regions. And as director of the Energy Institute in Morgantown, he oversees research into wind power, solar power, biomass, oil, shale gas, and coal production, among others. In 2013, Anderson won the President's Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers.
The White House, April 11th, 2014. Where are you in there?
I'm on the back row, three over from the president, wearing the red tie. Right
there, oh, yes, back. I see you. Okay.
In the decades to come, Brian Anderson believes all types of energy will be produced and used more locally. Experts call it distributed generation.
It's much like eating locally from locally produced farms and the like. If we can produce our energy in a much more local manner, then I think we start heading more towards sustainability. And so in West Virginia, maybe we can use a considerable amount of our geothermal and our wind and our solar and using our natural gas resources if we can do it sustainably, and even our coal. You know, we still have a huge coal resource in West Virginia, so we're really trying to work on ways that we can do that while minimizing its CO2 footprint, while minimizing its environmental impact. But we have been blessed with a resource, and it's our job to try to figure out how we can use that resource and use it sustainably.
Making coal production more environmentally friendly is a professional goal. But for Brian Anderson, it's also personal.
So my grandfather, my father's father, was a coal miner. Just passed away this year. My dad grew up in a coal camp and just outside of Montgomery. And, you know, I'm a West Virginian. I have coal running in my blood. I am... very mindful of what the resources we have provided to us and what they've taken away. So my grandfather, it was amazing. He lived to be 87 years old for decades of that with black lung. So for me, working in West Virginia is really a mandate. So I grew up for the first 11 years of my life on a road called Grace Road. Grace Road is between Reedy and Spencer, West Virginia, in Roane County. And about 2 miles out, Grace Road is a little community called Grace Community.
Brian Anderson's rural West Virginia roots run deep.
So we're turning now onto State Route 14, heading south toward Grace Road. And so as you see, this road's a nice, tight little windy road.
It's absolutely beautiful.
We just passed Wagon Run Road, and here this is the Woods Farm. On the right, this hillside is where we would come sleigh riding, usually on an inner tube. So we're approaching the house I grew up in. Okay. This is really the heart of the community and the densest part of the population, all 12 houses, if I'm being generous here. So here on the left, this little three-bedroom house, you know, I had my own bedroom as a kid. I was blessed. I really was blessed. And I was allowed to ride my bike to the park, right here to this steel pole entrance to the park.
A large, beautiful community park with a creek running through it.
This was my playground. As you can see my house from here. As long as it wasn't dark outside, I had to be home by dusk, but as long as I was either here at the park or in the yard at the house, my parents felt safe. It was a wonderful, wonderful place to grow up.
Brian and his sister went to school 2 miles away in Reedy.
Gene, we've just stopped along the road, and we're actually sitting on the remnants of what used to be the railroad that ran here through Reedy, West Virginia. We're about to enter Reedy, which is where I went to elementary school, where my mother was the principal.
In the early 1900s, Reedy, West Virginia was a boomtown due to the railroad and a steam-driven flour mill. It had its own hospital, newspaper, two banks, and a department store. But now it's smaller, with fewer businesses.
This was the second biggest town that I was used to. Spencer was the big town for me, but this was the center of my universe for the first 11 years of my life.
I'm Paulette Nestor. I'm Brian Anderson's mother. I'm a retired elementary school principal after being in education for 33 years. When Brian was a young child, he was very inquisitive. He would ask questions nonstop. There were times that we would be driving and he would be asking questions and answering them himself before any of us would answer for him. One time on a 45-minute drive, the rest of the family decided to be quiet. And Brian continued talking and asking questions and answering.
When Brian was 8 years old, his parents divorced, and when he was 11, he moved with his mother to Ripley, where he graduated valedictorian from Ripley High School, before going to WVU as a Foundation Scholar, the university's top scholarship for undergraduates. Anderson's 90-year-old maternal grandfather, John Paul Poling, spent most of his career as a maintenance supervisor at Kaiser Aluminum, but is also a writer, poet, local historian, and inventor. He remembers his grandson was always at the head of his class and very curious about how things work.
What I remember about Brian, he was always one that liked to tinker with something. And of course, well, he was here visiting us, you know. He liked to ask questions. And I've always been one myself, would like to follow through with some invention, trying to improve something. And he had always, what am I doing? Why are you doing this? He comes to visit. I ask him, you know, about his work and all. And my prayer is that the Lord will continue to use him.
Gene, we just crossed this little wooden bridge and we're pulling into the parking lot at Gilboa Baptist Church. My family is a spiritual and religious family, and so along with the Baptist heritage and the teachings of the church, it really comes down to the golden rule for my family and really treating others as you want to be treated. And with that, you know, it comes to also treating strangers like their friends and treating friends like their family. I first started singing in Gilboa Baptist Church in Roan County on Grace Road, and singing and music became one of my passions. My mother is an incredible pianist and singer, and I was, as a kid, just surrounded by great church music. But it wasn't until my junior year in high school that I joined a choir for the first time.
Brian continued to sing in choirs at WVU and at MIT, where he discovered that lots of scientists and engineers are interested in music.
And then finally auditioned for what is called the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, which is the house chorus for the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Brian Anderson singing Bruckner's Virga, Jesse, Floriat with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. The chorus also provided music for two Hollywood films. Secular, secular.
One movie is Mystic River, which was directed by Clint Eastwood, and it was filmed largely in Boston, and he used the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Tanglewood Festival Chorus to provide part of the score.
Gene Salento, the dean of the College of Engineering and Mineral Resources at WVU, always knew that Brian Anderson would do well.
I met Brian in 1995 when he came into the program as an undergraduate student, a foundation scholar. You could just tell that Brian was destined to do great things.
How could you tell it?
Just because he has a very bubbly personality, very extroverted, was very inquisitive, asked questions, was engaged, involved. You could tell he loved West Virginia. He loved the university and he loved the degree he was working on. But you can see Brian's probably among the top 1 or 2% of students I've had the pleasure of having taught.
In 38 years.
38 years, yeah.
As soon as he finished his postgraduate work at MIT, Brian Anderson returned to West Virginia University to teach and do research. Nevertheless, other top research institutions also wanted Brian Anderson. They've tried to lure him away. In 2014, one almost succeeded, Gordon Gee, president of West Virginia University.
Right after I came, I determined that it's in the interest of this state for us to establish a world-class energy institute, given what we are doing and given the qualities of this state, and we needed to have a world-class leader. And we had a young man here by the name of Brian Anderson who had just been recruited to go to Switzerland to have one of their major research programs. And I stopped him at the airport and said, "You've got to stay with us." I stopped him at the border. And we've made him the head of our energy institute here, and he's doing a wonderful job.
Is it true that you sort of threatened him about what we were going to do to him if he left?
Yeah, I told him I'd break his leg, and he's a little bit bigger than I am, as you know. He's a wonderful, handsome guy and an opera singer to boot. We don't want to export our talent. We don't mind if they go other places, but we want to have them come home. And I think that that is an inspirational story, someone who has gone away, has performed brilliantly academically, and has had a great professional life in front of him, but yet who made a decision that West Virginia was his home, and he's going to come home and do well here and do right here.
What I love about my job is working with so many great minds, with so many wonderful ideas, and the fact that part of my job is shouting from the rooftops how great the faculty and the students and the researchers are at WVU. And I love being able to try to work with all of these researchers and put together a bigger vision so that we are much better known on the national stage. You know, I have grand visions of West Virginia becoming a rich state, both rich in resources and rich in our healthy lifestyles. My hopes and dreams for myself really are that I can help contribute to finding energy solutions and do it to where three generations from now, we leave them the same beautiful West Virginia that we have today. You know, I just want to be a part of that.
A lot of that, I think, comes from the fact that he is a West Virginian, and we're dealing with West Virginia energy, we're dealing with West Virginia's future.
West Virginia is what made me who I am, and it's such an integral part of who I am that it really means everything to me. And it will never, never, ever leave me.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jean Snediger.
So today on our show, we've been hearing stories from a recent radio documentary called Inspiring West Virginians. The series features people from West Virginia who have succeeded in business or a STEM field. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. But for generations, men have dominated the math and science fields. Still, more and more women are starting to enter math and science professions. We recently caught up with one West Virginia native whose journey in a STEM field is just beginning.
My name is Senya Smoot Reinert, and I was born and raised in Charleston, West Virginia. I think that there is a big deficit of female teachers in the STEM fields, and I know that they're really trying to change that, and a lot of schools are really trying to bring more women into engineering, but it still is mostly male-dominated. I think my graduating class was at about 80 students, 10 were women, but that number is changing, and I do know in chemical engineering it was almost 50-50. And in my actual research focus, which is biomechanics, for whatever reason, it's extremely female-heavy. I think a lot of women who are in engineering are very interested in sort of the medical aspects and helping people and working with people in labs and in clinics. I don't know, one tip is I think that when you get a lot of really, really smart kids together, especially some who have that stereotypical engineering slight awkwardness, it's very easy to think that everyone else is a genius and you're not. And then you get in group work and you realize everyone's struggling. And every now and then one person's a genius at something and they can pull the group through. But that's only one part of the puzzle. And as intimidating as it can be, I think everyone's intimidated by that. I think girls just think that it's just them, though, sometimes.
But there was one particular teacher who inspired Senya to recognize that women can be talented at math and science.
I will say, shout out to Monica Hatfield. She was my math teacher in middle school who pulled me aside one day and told me I was very good at math and I should keep pursuing it.
And so Senya did end up going into a field where she uses a lot of math. She's a PhD engineering student at Dayton University in Ohio. And in 2011, she was even awarded a fellowship from the National Science Foundation to pursue her graduate research in biomechanics. Her research is intended to help occupational therapists who are developing therapies for people with autism.
And actually, it ties back to Charleston. When I was in high school, I started working with a local family whose son had been diagnosed with autism. And I was part of just sort of this team of people who helped conduct at-home therapy with him, who would take him to different therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, group play, and I just really loved the family, and I really loved him, and it made me really passionate about helping kids who had developmental disorders. And then my undergrad degree is in mechanical engineering, but something I got very interested in is a field of mechanical engineering called biomechanics, where you use engineering principles and tools to study human performance. People do it to improve sports equipment or athletes' performance, but they also do it a lot clinically to better understand a certain pathology or disorder or disease. And so my master's work, and actually that's what I got the NSF grant for, was I was evaluating physiological changes that were occurring as a result of pretty popular therapy called sensory integration therapy. So I was working with little kids who were on the autism spectrum, and we were doing things like measuring their postural stability and how well they could control their upright posture. We did something called gaze tracking where the kids loved it. They got to wear these like super cool spy glasses, but they actually tracked the children's visual fixations. And I also did something called gait analysis where you study how people walk and how fast they walk and the different cadence they use and how even their steps are to each other.
Senya's research found that the therapy likely does help autistic children improve their sensory and physical abilities. Her research is still ongoing, and it's developed into her doctoral dissertation topic. Senya says once her dissertation is complete, she's not sure where her career will take her, but West Virginia will always be home.
I always had a very strong sense of place. My husband, Jimmy, always teases me because I talk whenever I'm in Ohio about how much I miss West Virginia and how pretty it is, and I miss the people there and just the slight warmth to the culture. And I will always be home in a way that I don't think any place I'll ever live will be. And so that's something I've noticed that some students, they're a lot more open about moving around a lot and aren't as fixated, I think, on that idea of home that myself and a lot of my friends who have left West Virginia have. Even though Dayton is only 3 hours from Charleston, it was actually scarier than I thought it would be to leave the state, especially because I didn't have a car for many years as an undergraduate student. I felt like I was very far away, but you know, Dayton's a great town and something that a lot of Dayton people think Dayton's really small and there's nothing to do, but it's a lot bigger than Charleston, so I thought that it was pretty fun to explore.
And to any young people out there who are good at math and thinking about studying engineering, Cindy says don't be put off thinking all engineers do is sit behind a desk all day. Biomechanical engineers help design running shoes for athletes. They help make comfy chairs for us to sit in. And they can even help people recovering from a stroke. Cindy's advice? Get together with your classmates outside of class and remember that engineering is interactive.
Another tip for high schoolers I would suggest is a lot of colleges have an engineering summer camp. Often, I went to a women in engineering summer camp as a junior at GW. The camp was at the University of Dayton, but UD also offers a general engineering camp. They also offered a minorities in engineering summer camp, and I loved it. I spent a day shadowing a construction engineer. I got to do small experiments in all the major labs on campus. You sort of get an early reassurance that engineering, even though it's a lot about knowing how to solve your own problems, it is very group work oriented. We had a couple different challenges given to small groups, about four people, and we get to design things to try to overcome them. And it was a lot of fun. We were high schoolers running around a college campus. We thought it was a blast.
Again, that was 28-year-old Senya Smoot Reinert, a native of Charleston, West Virginia, who's now studying biomechanics and engineering at the University of Dayton. Well, that's our show. I see a lot of posts on social media saying that they'd rather see positive, uplifting, or inspiring stories about Appalachia than hear about your stereotypical images. Well, now's your chance to spread some good news from the region. I'm curious to see the podcast subscriptions after this episode airs, so be sure to tell your friends. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and basically any other podcast delivery service. Just look up Inside Appalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the radio documentary Inspiring West Virginians. Music in today's show was also provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Anna and Elizabeth, Little Sparrow, Jake Sheps, and Andrea Tomasi. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.